Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody. Welcome to another episode of With All Dude Respect. With All Dude Respect, the radio show that answers the question, what the hell is really going on out there? My name is Jim Ellis. I'm here on the West Coast, co-host of With All Dude Respect. Now, our co-host on the East Coast happens to be on location at something called Yankee Stadium. So he will be actually watching a baseball game right now. So I'll be hosting this show by myself. But when I found out that Mr. Rick Wright will be watching the Yankees, I decided, well, who can I get on this show with me to talk about some men's topics and what's really going on? And I thought of a couple of men that I met at the NCFM conference, National Coalition for Men conference, a couple weeks ago in Old Town San Diego. And the conversation that these two were having, they presented at that conference. And it had to do with what's happening on college campuses, at least in our nation, around the due process or the lack of due process for young men who are accused of sexual harassment. So when I was sitting there watching these two talk about this topic, I was like amazed and kind of depressed about what was going on in our own nation, a nation built on freedom, based on due process, all those great qualities. So what I wanted to do is have these two on. I'll introduce the first man because he's already on the line, Mr. Gregory Joseph Chuck. He's a board member of the National Coalition for Men. It's the oldest men's human rights organization in America. And he also serves as the president of NCFM in the Carolinas chapter. And he also serves as the committee chairman of the NCFM College Initiative Work Group. So let's go ahead and welcome Mr. Gregory on the line. How are you doing, Gregory?
Jim, I'm doing great. Good to hear you again.
Yes, it's good to hear you. We keep crossing paths. I really appreciate you taking the time and the energy. This will be some of the fastest 30 minutes that we get because it goes by fast. But so I want to jump into this now. We'll invite in the other guest if he makes it. He's a USC student, actually a student right now at USC, and he has a lot to say. We'll see if he makes it or not. He's out there trying to connect on Skype. We'll see if that works. But for now, can we just start off by saying that, yes, rape and sexual harassment, it does happen and it should be held accountable, because what happens is sometimes people believe, people like you that are talking about, you know, due process and the rights of young men are something called rape apologists. Can we just clear that up right now, like that whole misinformation there?
Sure. Well, I mean, I totally agree that rape does happen. Sexual violence, unfortunately, does happen, you know, in our country, and that includes on college campuses. And we absolutely oppose it. We feel that any allegation of sexual violence should be investigated, properly investigated by trained law enforcement. I mean, if we're looking at something like sexual assault, we're talking about a felony crime. We're talking about rape here. So it should be investigated by trained law professionals. Evidence should be collected and preserved. And the rights of the accused, there should always be a presumption of innocence. But there should be foundational rights. And those rights are found, in fact, in criminal court proceedings. Unfortunately, this issue became very politicized, and in fact, the last administration under President Obama essentially weaponized a law around Title IX, and weaponized it in such a manner that extended it into this area of essentially policing the sex lives of college students. And it's been a weapon that's been used to drum out and quickly, rapidly expel any male student accused of sexual misconduct. And anyone that believes or speaks out that the accused should have fundamental due process rights is automatically, as you mentioned, kind of broadly painted with this label of rape apologist, which is, of course, ludicrous and absurd.
Oh, it's crazy. Have you actually been called that in your
I have been called that.
How do you stay? You got to stay centered, right? You can't just be like, you just got to stay with the black and white and the facts, and the fact that you're just basically trying to take care of what should be all of our rights in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're just trying to ensure that the scales of justice are fair and equitable for all people. And unfortunately, as I said, you know, with the issuance of something called the 2011 Dear Colleague Letter by the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, the federal government essentially placed the thumb on those scales and tilted, denied due process. All kinds of rights were you know, essentially swept away. And you weren't presumed innocent. You were presumed guilty, and you had to try to attempt to prove your innocence. Unfortunately, they didn't give you the ammunition to even do that because the university could determine whether they wanted to allow exculpatory evidence into the hearing or not. And in a lot of cases, they did not. I could tell you all kinds of stories, and we may get into a few, but one that comes to mind that I can think of is a young man was accused of sexual misconduct. He had a list of witnesses that were ready to testify that he could not, in fact, have done what was alleged at the time it was alleged at, to have happened at, and the hearing administrator dismissed his witnesses, told them they didn't need to testify. And so what we really see playing out on these college campuses are what we call kangaroo courts. You're presumed innocent. You go in 30 minutes later, an hour later, they rubber stamp an expulsion or a long-term suspension, and you're gone. That's it.
Right. So, yeah, I want to get into some of how it came to be. You mentioned Title IX. You mentioned the colleague letter. I want to get into that history in a little bit. Before we go there, I do want to just kind of give just for the audience, like, what is actually happening here? You painted some pictures, you know, you said things like the due process isn't happening, meaning you're not innocent until proven guilty. Can you also cover things, how the universities do have their own, basically their own justice system, which includes like no cross-examination? I mean, what else? And then we're going to bring our other guests on in just a minute. What else is happening at the university level that doesn't happen in the criminal court level? That makes sense.
Yeah. So, Jim, great question. I think, you know, it starts with, and I was surprised to find this out on, you know, discovering that when you become a college student, when you are enrolled, you have essentially given away your constitutional rights. The universities they have their own policies. They have their own way of governing students, student conduct. They have their own laws, if you will, that apply to students. Once you accept admission to that university, you have accepted those rules that are going to govern you as long as you are an enrolled student. And, you know, basically it's their sandbox. They make the rules. They determine how they're going to hold a hearing, who's going to be allowed in the hearing, who's not going to be allowed in the hearing, what questions may or may not be asked. You, in this case, you mentioned, and you rightfully so, that, you know, under a Title IX sexual misconduct hearing, they don't allow cross-examination of the accuser. It's a nightmare world that I think few Americans would know of, or because if they did, I think there'd be rioting in the streets, and clearly there is not.
Right. So thank you for that, and I'm going to bring up some more topics around that idea about the differences. I do want to bring in Mr. John Doe. Now, his name's John Doe because he does want to, you know, keep his name you know, confidential, because right now he is a USC student who intends to study law. He's a political moderate who is interested in challenging the entrenched anti-male bias in campus tribunals. And he pays close attention to the evolution of case law on this particular subject. How are you doing there, John? How are you?
Thank you very much, Jim. Can you hear me? Just to clarify.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we hear you well.
Cool.
Good job on the Skype. So we're talking about the differences.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. We're talking about the differences between, you know, the university campus, you know, policies and ways of being and their own justice system, as opposed to the criminal justice system, where you have things like you can cross-examine the accuser to find out, you know, what's going on their side. What have you seen, because you're a USC student right now, what have you seen as far as the differences and some of the injustices that are happening?
So let me just really emphasize the main difference in the court system, and I don't think this is just a criminal justice issue, but also in civil courts, there's always a presumption that a judge will always arrive at a conclusion that is free of conflict of bias, right? And I mean, a judge doesn't really, let's say, have a stake, kind of like a financial stake in the outcome of any given result. And if a judge, let's say, has a significant conflicts of interest, then they are expected to recuse themselves. Whereas in universities actually have a significant financial incentive to basically find every accused male student responsible. So I've been kind of like listening to Greg's kind of like points, and I think they're like really good points. And I completely agree that denial of cross-examination is a significant problem. But I think the problem is actually much more foundational than that. So basically you have these corporations, because it's ultimately what they are. I mean, USC is a private institution, so it's basically a corporation. And these corporations have very significant financial incentives to create an environment that is hostile against men. And I think that's really the most fundamental issue at stake. If you think of it, part of it, of course, becomes part of it comes from the previous Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, Catherine Lehman, who threatened colleges with withdrawal of federal funding if they did not, you know, if they were not aggressive enough in prosecuting these cases. So that's definitely one incentive. But there are also more local reasons as well. For example, and I think this issue was brought up for the first time in a paper called A Hostile Environment for Student Defendants by Stephen Hendrick, I think. So that's actually his observation, not mine. And the observation he made was, when an accused male student brings a lawsuit against the university for due process violations, then even if he can prevail on the merits, what happens is that like the university has to pay a very small amount of damages and perhaps reinstitute the student in basically like kind of give his degree back. Whereas when a female student or a number of female students band together to file a Title IX lawsuit against any given university, then they sue the school for much more significant amounts of damages. So they basically sue the schools for millions of dollars. So what you have is institutions are basically expected to choose between, you know, siding with female students, in which case they may potentially pay for like millions of dollars for damages, or side with male students, in which case, even if the male student can prevail at court, the damages that they will have to pay would be significantly smaller. So there has been some changes in this, and male students have been consistently bringing Title IX lawsuits. But I think even in the most settlements, I know that some settlements have been favorable to male students, the amount of damages that institutions have to pay is still smaller. So there is actually a very hardwired financial incentive for these institutions to discriminate against men. And I don't know if that...
A lot of it does have to do with finances. In fact, the way I understand it, and I'm just pretty much new to this, either one of you, if you want to answer, if this institution doesn't follow through on this, you know, Dear Colleague letter provisions that were put out,
the federal government could take away its funding.
Is that true? Of the campuses?
Yes and no. So that's kind of a complicated question.
Okay.
I mean, especially in an institution like, let's say, the University of Southern California receives an exorbitant amount of money from the federal government, and that's, I think, $500 million. So I cannot really imagine a relatively low-ranking federal bureaucrat like the assistant secretary cutting off that money in its entirety. So in a certain sense, it's a theoretical punishment, which has never happened. So no institution actually had their federal funds deprived for Title IX violations, so in practice. But I mean, I think Catherine Lehman was aggressive enough with these, they are called letters of impending action. So when the OCR basically sends a letter to the institution saying, we can take away your federal funding if you don't do what we are saying. I think she was aggressive enough with this to actually create a sense of apprehension in institutions. Even though in reality, I don't think it's something that can take place. I cannot really imagine the Congress being amused, you know, if, again, like a relatively low-ranking federal bureaucrat actually suspends such a large amount of money to an institution. So it's kind of theoretical. And I think the main reason is the reason that I just mentioned, like basically female students can collect much more substantial amounts than male students. I think that's probably the more substantial reason, if that makes sense. But
yeah,
I mean, they both contribute to this problem. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some kind of conflict of interest in there. Go ahead, Greg.
Jim, I'm sorry. I think I would, you know, maybe just differ a little with John's opinion in that just the threat alone, not the fact that they've never done it, but just the mere threat that they could cut off federal funding if the outcome didn't go the way that, you know, that the OCR was looking for. That was enough to kind of tip the scales dramatically at that point. And you know, think about, I mean, put yourself in the chair of the university chancellor, whether it's at USC or any large public state school system. And, you know, do we roll the dice and side with the accused, and risk just the potential of risk of hundreds of millions of dollars in federal aid? Or do we say, you know what, if you don't like the outcome and you don't feel you received due process, then go ahead and sue us.
Right. Yeah, so it definitely, creates a situation where the scales are tipped. Yeah, the other situation I want to bring up in what's happening right now, and it might be changing, and we'll get to that as well. September 22nd, there was a new ruling that was coming down from Ms. DeVos, but we'll get to that. But right now what could be happening is and Gregory, you mentioned this in your talk, is the idea of preponderance of evidence. That's one situation, you know, that's taking place. It's that situation, as well as what I heard you say once, Greg, was the person that is listening to the case must believe the woman at the start, not have an open mind or be fair, but must believe the woman. Can you cover those two parts,
sure,
Greg?
Sure. So one of the key provisions of the 2011 Dear Colleague letter was the lowering of the evidentiary standard. Prior to the issuance of that letter in 2011, the vast majority of universities across the country was using a much higher evidentiary standard around clear and convincing evidence. And essentially the 2011 guidance letter said, no, that's too high of a standard when you're adjudicating Title IX sexual misconduct cases. So you need to lower it down to a preponderance of the evidence. Now, for those that are listening today and maybe are not acquainted, what does that standard preponderance of the evidence really mean? Well, essentially, it means that it lowers it down to kind of this 50% plus a feather. So if you believe that the evidence, is at least 50% plus a feather more on one side versus the other, whether it's on the accuser or the accused, then you are to decide that case in that person's favor. Okay? So that's just a horrific standard, especially when you take away, you know, all these other rights, the rights to examine and cross-examine the accuser, the right to, you know, show that you have evidence that counters that claim when that's being denied and you're not allowed to enter that. And there's just a laundry list of rights that were taken away. And, by the way, the other thing that they provided guidance was, and we want this entire case from the moment it is filed to the moment it's decided to be in 60 days or less. Mm-hmm. So essentially, hurry up and get it through. Get it through very quickly and get it done with. That was really the signal that came out of the preponderance of the evidence and dear colleague letter guidance. Now, I'm sorry, okay. Jim, remind me your second part of your question.
Two questions at once. But you had mentioned during your presentation that the person reviewing the case must believe the woman at the normally it's a woman, of course, must believe the woman at the very start, not have an open mind, but must believe the accuser.
Thank you for that. So when they put in the new, well, at that time, the guidance in 2011, all right, it created this domino effect, and part of the domino effect was, well, we need to, number one, hire more Title IX coordinators, and we just saw this absurd army of people get hired up. I mean, I, as an example, in my home state here in North Carolina, prior to the 2011 Dear Colleague letter, the Title IX office had two full-time people working in it, okay? That was because they always had a light caseload of claims of sexual violence on that campus. Now, when you broaden out the definition of what is sexual harassment, sexual violence, like what happened when you politicize this issue, and then you create funding, so they went from two people to 17 people almost overnight, okay? And if you think that's a crazy number, Harvard has 55 people working in their Title IX office. 55. Now, if you need that many people, you ought to shut Harvard down. If you have that many cases on the campus of Harvard, you ought to shut it down, because Harvard would then, by default, be the most dangerous. It would be more dangerous in Harvard to walk the campus as a woman than it would be in a third world country.
Right.
So to get to your point of your question, they created this guidance, they created funding for training, and then they sent these people to training, and the people that trained the Title IX investigators started the training off with, you must believe a woman would never lie about sexual assault or sexual violence. They would never lie about that. That's the training they gave these people.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, John, I want to ask a question of John, because we're talking about what constitutes sexual harassment. So, John, right now you're a young man on a college campus. What I understand that it can be something construed to, like, you must get a confirmation yes on almost every single move, like every single move towards a woman. I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but how do you, John, define sexual harassment, and how do you deal with maybe some constrictions of such a definition?
So actually everything can be sexual harassment, so that's kind of the issue. And I was actually involved in a Title IX case myself, and here the accusation was, so these are kind of like verbatim statements, but she said he was manipulating my emotions and lying to me by telling me that he was not attracted to me. So that was an accusation. So just to repeat, like, this woman made a sexual harassment accusation by basically saying that he was lying to me by saying that he was not attracted to me. So that's basically, I mean, that really violates like Aristotelian logic. kind of like really kind of like anybody might think that that doesn't kind of like fit into common sense or anything, but I was actually sanctioned with one-time counseling for this. So so first of all, like this whole idea that, and I think it goes back to Catherine McKinnon. I don't know if you know this person, but she was she is a law professor in Yale, and Yale is a particularly obnoxious school when it comes to Title IX, kind of anti-male hostile environment. And she basically claimed that I call it rape or harassment whenever a woman feels subjectively violated. So according to this perspective, anything that a woman believes is or should constitute harassment is harassment. So of course, there's no way such a crazy idea can pass like a constitutional muster or really kind of like sound logic. But what they do is, and I kind of want to emphasize this and just kind of like adding to Greg's point, is the Dear Colleague letter and the preponderance standard, these are not the only issues at hand. And I mean, especially these victim advocates keep saying that the preponderance standard should be maintained because it is also the standard that is used in all other civil cases. And that is technically true. But the thing is, like, there are so many other protections that they have taken away, basically, like cross-examination is one of them. And I think, generally speaking, this Title IX administrators have too much freedom to choose basically what is evidence and what is not evidence. So that gives them too much power to basically decide the outcome of a case. And okay, that's kind of like another main problem. And again, training materials, this is, I think in many ways, this is kind of like the really crux of the problem. So these people have been trained, like they've been receiving this ideological dogma over perhaps more than a decade. And they do believe that one in four women will be, again, like assaulted in college, even though I actually run a really complex analysis of that. Like there's, and many people have debunked this. It's no way, like there's no way that can be true. But also they basically deny that men can be victims of harassment in any way or form. And any male student who wants to file a complaint meets significant resistance from this Title IX parasite, basically. And that's okay, another kind of issue. And
okay,
again,
I want to jump in. This is the fastest 30 minutes of our lives. I want to jump in and say, yes or no, were you expelled or were you just given counseling?
No, I wasn't expelled or suspended.
Yeah. Given counseling for not taking up a woman on her offer. Okay, so I want to just, there's something that just happened last week I want to get to, and I want to, for our audience, I want to let them know what the Dear Colleague letter is. I mean, you could look up, you can Google that. You could also Google Title IX, which is Title IX. You can Google that. But the Dear Colleague letter was in April 4th, 2011. The Office of the Civil Rights under the Obama administration released a letter called the Dear Colleague letter. It was sent to over 7,000 universities that are receiving federal funding. And it basically stated the universities needed to address the concerns of on-campus sexual assault by adhering to these lists of guidelines. Okay, that we've been talking about some of these. Now, on Friday, September 22nd, Betsy DeVos, all right, the Secretary of Education of the Trump administration, announced the rollback of these guidelines. The decision, while being highly criticized as hurting sexual assault survivors, a lot of people are supportive. Gregory, where are you with that? I mean, is this a super positive situation so that the males that are being falsely accused are going to get a fair shake? What do you see?
Well, it's definite. It's a big step in the right direction. The rollback, the withdrawing of the 2011 Dear Colleague letter is a huge step in the right direction. They have issued interim guidelines now. And I'm not fully comfortable with the interim guidelines. As an example, they are not mandating that they go to a higher level evidentiary standard. They're saying we'll leave it up to the schools. The schools can decide if they want to stay with the preponderance of evidence standard or if they want to, you know, go to the clear and convincing standard. But this is all interim until they change the regulations. And they're going to go through the public comment process, a process that was not followed when the 2011 Dear Colleague letter was issued. It did not go out for public comment. It was just a decree from above. You shall do it this way. And so I know we're tight on time here, so I'll just simply say it is a step in the right direction. But we still have until we can see what the new regulations say. I think environment for male students out on college campuses.
Well, thank you for that. We're going to go a little bit over time because this is such a rich, topic, and it's very timely, especially with DeVos's latest statements. Can I just ask either one of you, what is the consequence for a female or any accuser to falsely accuse? Is there any consequence that they face?
Nothing. Can I respond to this?
Yeah, there is, I have not seen, and I've tracked, well over 100 cases, I have not seen a single accuser that has alleged, falsely accused someone have any sort of punishment or anything. I mean, there's nothing that has happened to that person.
Yeah, okay. I think, because I knew that there was this one case where, this was actually in high school. There's one case of a gentleman that was a high school, superstar in football. Woman falsely accused him, and he spent 10 years, 5 years in prison, and ended up later being found out that they had a recording of her admitting that, oh, yeah, he didn't rape me. And what's his, what does he get out of it? He gets his freedom. But what about those 5 years, It's kind of crazy. I want to also mention, so the opposing side says things like, this is continuing a pattern, the idea of rolling back, the colleague letter, it's a continuing a pattern of undermining survivors' rights. They also say this is a backward step, invites colleges to once again sweep sexual violence under the rug. What do you say to this this opposing side? I mean, what can you say to that?
Well, I'll take that first, and then I'll let John maybe speak to that. But, I think, first of all, Secretary DeVos's words, in when she made her announcement, and I'm going to quote now, she said, interim guidance will help schools as they work to combat sexual misconduct and will treat all students fairly. Schools must continue to confront these horrific crimes and behaviors head on. There will be no more sweeping them under the rug, but the process also must be fair and impartial, giving everyone more confidence in its outcomes. I mean, that's the answer right there, and the other side just doesn't want to hear that. They don't want to hear, for some reason, the other side on this issue believes that it's a zero-sum game. So if accused men all of a sudden have due process rights restored to them, somehow they equate that to sweeping allegations underneath the rug. It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd, the logic that they apply here.
Okay. And the last question I have, and maybe John, I don't know if you want to cover this, what can be done? I mean, we have listeners, it could be all over the world, What can be done by just the common person around this situation?
I want to very briefly respond to the issue of false accusations. So in theory, they can actually be penalized, and there is actually a federal contract between the Department of Education and the university stipulating the punishment of false accusations, but it never happens. And I think even in cases, there was a recent case, a student called Arman Premji was falsely accused, and he was able to produce surveillance camera records, which conclusively refutes the allegations, but still nothing ever happens to these women. And I think the main problem here is selective enforcement. It's not just due process. So women never get punished for anything under Title IX. And I think that really is the most fundamental problem. You mentioned Brian Banks. That was the, football player that you mentioned.
Right.
And he was actually a USC student at some point, if I remember correctly. He did serve 5 years in prison. And the woman actually sued the school for several million dollars, basically after making up this false rape accusation, and she got the money. And after that, she was sued back, so the money was taken from her. But still, she served no prison sentence, nothing. She served no real punishment for what she has done. So even in a case, but that did involve the criminal justice system. So he was actually in prison. And many of these women who make false accusations actually do not go to the police, because women who file false police reports can actually be prosecuted. I mean, it's still like 30 days in jail, usually something like that. But still, they don't want that, which is why they specifically prefer Title IX complaints instead of the criminal justice system.
I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're so short on time. We have about 1 minute left. I do want to hear from Greg or some, you know, either John or Greg. What can any one of us out here do? Anything specifically, research, anything?
Absolutely, and thank you. So the first thing anyone listening could do is to write a letter to Secretary DeVos. And if you believe that due process rights should be provided to college students that are facing any sort of Title IX investigation, then let that be known. I mean, she wants to hear from the public. She's asking to hear from the public, and I would certainly expect the public to weigh in on this. They can write to the Department of Education. They can write directly. You can go Google her address up on there. I believe it's, might be wrong. I think it's BetsyDeVos@ed.gov, but I might be wrong there.
Okay.
But that would be, to me, the surest and quickest thing they can do is call the Department of Education, write the Department of Education, tweet the Department of Education, any of those things to let your voice be heard on this issue.
Yeah, there you go. So, again, I said it was going to be a fast 30 minutes. It's a fast 35, 36 now. So I want to thank both of you. I mean, so people out there,
thanks.
You know.
I can just add, like, something.
I'm sorry. No, we have to go. But I do want to thank you, John Doe, Gregory, Joseph, Chuck. But okay, I guess real quick. Well, no, we can't do that. I was trying to think of how to maybe get a hold of you. Is there a way to get a hold of either of you?
Way for me is to go to our NCFM Carolinas website. Up there is our telephone number and also our email, which is ncfmcarolinas@yahoo.com. By all means, they can contact me that way.
Okay, and John, last word, what do you got?
I just want to say that Betsy DeVos's email is betsy.devos, then it's @ed.gov. So that's just what there's a dot between her name and her last name.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thank you, John. Yeah. Thank you, Gregory. Thank you for being on our show. Really appreciate the time and energy you're spending, not just right here in these 37 minutes, but everything that you're doing out there. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Yes. So there's our show, ladies and gentlemen. With all due respect, thank you for joining us. You can find us on Facebook, With All Due Respect. You can look that up. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you next Friday, 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Take care.
Thank you.